Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need.
Housed every single person who died as a result of homelessness in this city last year. Somebody froze to death, cold, dark, and alone on Christmas night. On Christmas night, while apartments sit empty. This is a farce. This is an atrocity. And somebody needs to make the point that this city, on an annual basis, is publicly executing poor people by slow torture.
Social
because
murder.
Because that is what happens when you force somebody onto the streets of this city in the winter and don't allow them to go inside. They die. They die slowly. They die alone in the dark, waiting for somebody to come and help them, and nobody does. So the idea that we are just going to just pass a budget that provides nothing for people who are dying, people who are going hungry, people who are becoming sick, becoming disabled, dying years before their time. The life expectancy of a homeless person in this city is 30 years lower than that of a housed person. 30 years. How can we countenance this? How can we allow this to happen year after year after year? And this is going to be presided over by a man who is supposed to have resigned already? This is a farce. This is a farce. And worse than that, it's a farce covering up murder. And this can't be the sort of thing that we gloss over with polite language and decorum and all these rules of polite society that let us look away from people shivering and shuddering under sleeping bags on heating vents in a city full of empty luxury apartments.
Greetings. What you just heard there was an impassioned speech by a community member within the Toronto City Council chambers. A budget meeting was going on earlier this week in which many community members were removed. They were there protesting, or rather wanting to have input on the Toronto $16 billion operating budget. Now, most of you will know that Toronto is in a bit of political turmoil at the moment. The mayor, Tory, has resigned eventually amidst an admission of an affair and abuse of power, abuse of office, and was still proceeding over these budget meetings. Now, in the absence of that, I think we can say that budget was already a problem. It was increasing the police budget after repeated calls by community members and many organizations to start defunding the police, and it's anything but. There was a real desperation, I think, to have Tory ensure that budget went through, and community members wanted a say. This wasn't a big news ticket item. However, our producer, Santiago Helu Quintero, was there on the ground in the City Hall chambers, and the experience had a profound effect on him in a myriad of ways that we're going to spend the episode discussing. And it also brought up broader questions on working within the confines that are provided to us to make the change that we need and what that means for democracy, what all of these interactions meant for not him, only him personally, but also a bigger political question. So Santiago, you decided to go down to City Hall. I think a lot of organizations, big and small, had encouraged folks to be a part of these budget discussions to make it clear that they were not happy with it. There was a bit of a rally outside. You want to take us from there and just give folks a kind of rough idea on how that day unfolded, and we'll unpack it from there, friend?
Yeah. I mean, I actually hadn't decided to go to City Hall that day. It was so I'm a student journalist. I mentioned that on this show before, and a classmate of mine who wanted to cover the story, they knew that I had a lot of knowledge, experience with the unhoused community, with issues surrounding that, that I had connections within that because of my activism. And they thought that it would be good to bring me on to the story because of that. So they asked me if I would come with them that day. And I did. I usually stay out of covering these kinds of stories when I'm there as a student journalist and not for something like Blueprints or anything that I do outside, because I want to be able to do these stories justice. And so, yeah, we went there. I got there pretty early in the morning before anything really kicked off outside. There was a lot of camera crews, media attention. There was a lot of people there that day. Protesters were already showing up from a variety of different organizations. There was a QP locale. Acorn had some people there. A lot of people who were just unaffiliated with any organization and who were frustrated.
And exercising their democratic right to participate in this, right? There is a public gallery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I recognized a few people early on, started talking with them, you know, trying to ask questions, you know, what are you doing here? What is your goal today? Do you want to maybe talk to me after? We can get your opinion on record, you know. And from there, you know, I'd never been inside a City Hall except for one time previous, like 6-7 years ago when I didn't know up and down, you know. And I think I just wanted to like walk around because, ooh, government building looked cool, you know. It was, so I had never seriously been in there, but I go up to the global news journalist and I say, you know, hey, I'm a student journalist. I was just wondering, can I, am I allowed as a student journalist into the press area at the top of the city council? They're like, yeah, absolutely. Just go in, follow other journalists. They'll guide you through this. So go in, go through security. I end up on the second floor outside of John Tory's office. There was a media scrum going on.
Of course.
Quite an interesting one to run into. I'm sure a lot of people have seen the clips where it was the speaker, forget her name.
Frances Nunziata.
Yes. Mm. And she was essentially giving a lot of arguments as to why Tory should not resign, you know, very much on the lines of Doug Ford scandal.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, where she was saying stuff along the lines of, oh, you know, he should take time off. He'll get investigated by Integrity Commissioner. If he gets cleared, he'll come back, you know?
Maybe the Integrity Commissioner went to his wedding.
Maybe. I mean, it seems like, yeah. Anyways, and, you know, Gord Perks comes up into the scrum at one point, voices his opinions. And this is interesting for me because I've never, like, seen a media scrum before in person. So I was just like, I was just happy to be there, you know. I was just taking pictures, wasn't saying anything, you know. And then I, there was a CBC journalist and I'm like, hey, how do I get up there? And I tell them again, at all times I am identifying, I'm a student journalist, I'm with Humber News. How do I get
up? You don't
have
any glossy creds on or anything?
My fellow students did. I spent like a good 40 minutes looking for it in the morning. Couldn't find it. I actually did eventually find it. You know, I mean, you can see we're not recording.
You really
videos,
do so. Have one.
Yeah, I have one. Media for validation call, you know, has the name of my professors on it. Yeah, so.
In case you get in trouble.
No, I mean, not yet, not at that point, but so, you know.
So you're soaking up this media scrum.
Soaking it up. It ends and, you know, meeting's going to start in 5 minutes and I find my way up with, I just follow the other journalists, the one who I mentioned, who I identified myself to. I just follow them up, end up in the press gallery.
Within the chambers?
Yes.
And were you expecting a show?
Honestly, well, I mean, I know how things are, so I expected protests outside. I had run into several people on my way up, so I kind of, at that point, was like, oh, there might be something going on. I'm not really
sure.
You
know those faces. Yeah. Because, like, okay, I'm asking you not in, like, did you know, as in, did you plan a disturbance? But you get that feeling, right? And you know how the city's feeling right now. And there's, you know.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I said when my classmate asked me to be a part of this was, I said, hey, maybe we can interview some of the protesters, because I imagine, and they're like, are there going to be protesters? And I said, I imagine so.
I hope so. That's what you're thinking.
I hope so. I hope so, but also just, I assume. And so we get up there, and right at the beginning, there was a community member who started voicing their concern that they had reached out the previous day asking for accommodations. They're a person with disabilities and they wanted rightfully their accommodations. They got ignored. They voiced that. At first, the speaker tried to kick them out. Then when it kind of became too much of a show, they provided them the accommodations, and then the person continued to, you know, voice some concerns as one does as a member of a democratic society, voice your concerns against the government, constitutional rights and all that. And the session gets suspended and they kick media out. And I immediately go up to some of the journalists and I'm like, hey, I noticed that we're kicked out, but none of you are leaving. What's up?
Now, here's a question. Did anyone leave?
Well, at that was the first one. That was the first one. And so,
and not so even
CBC,
the Globe and Mail
goes live on air. And, you know, they're like, okay, and at this moment in time, we are being kicked out of the city council chambers after, very live on air. And right here beside me, security is asking me, you know, like.
I'm there. So, I can feel it.
Yeah. I'm like, okay.
Are you getting nervous?
Well, you know, I didn't expect to get this far in the first place. I don't really know what I'm doing here. So yeah, you know, we all leave. We go into the hallway, and there, yeah, one of the city councilors. I mentioned their name, but I forget their name. It was stayed behind. It was one of the, like, not a lefty, but I think one, like, one of the liberal ones.
I think it's important to make a note here or ask you, why did they remove the media?
Yeah, well, whenever they cleared it, they cleared the media. I don't know if that's the usual procedure, but I don't think it should be. Media should be able to... I imagine that it's because they don't want footage of protesters getting forcefully removed.
Yeah, this wasn't about removing media for, you know, a closed door session, right? Like to be confidential as a city does its business. This was a clear precursor to a potential forceful removal of community members.
Yes, that was very much how it came across, was we don't want media here for the removal process.
Isn't that what media is for?
City councilors were asked to leave, but not all of them did. Most of them did, but one of them did stay behind to ensure the safety of the protester, to ensure that they were taken care of. And
who was
and
it?
I forgot.
It was Josh Matlow. You already told me the story, but I wanted to give credit where it was due, because I know not a lot of lefties enjoy his politics. Even rumored to be the next progressive choice. We'll talk about that maybe a little later, but Josh Matlow.
Yeah, Josh Matlow. And credit to him, he stayed behind, made sure that things went as safely as possible, that they were not harmed. And when the session later resumed, they made a point of order. I think it was a point of order. I forget my Robert's rules and all
that. This is like an NDP convention flashback all over again, between challenging the chair for accommodations and getting shouted down.
Very much familiar in that sense. And then they presented all of the points that that community member wanted voiced. And they said it before council. And credit where credit's due. good for them. But so in the meantime, you know, they say it's going to take 5 minutes. I think it was a good 45-minute interruption during which I was in a hallway. Yes, so I'm in the hallway and I see some there are some community members who were later I would learn there to protest and I recognize a few of them, some from the NDP, some from previous protests against police at the encampment evictions, people I know from all over. And then there's Miguel, who I will say is at every protest ever. They know him very well at City Hall and everywhere. Just no secret that Miguel was there. Miguel will always be everywhere.
And Desmond Cole, you ran into?
Desmond Cole I ran into later. He actually stayed behind with the city council to ensure the safety of the community member who was being removed. Shout out to Desmond Cole. So I stay, you know, in the hallway. We're talking, we're chatting. Some of the protesters are in arguments with some of the city staff members, which it got entertaining. But at that point, you know, I recognize people, say hi to people. Everything is as it should, I think, you know. And yeah, so we stay there about 45 minutes. Then council resumes and Josh Matlow interrupts, as I said, to say his piece. And then all is back to regularly scheduled programming, I guess. I'm back up in at the top of the gallery. And
they let everyone that they had asked leave back in?
Yes, everyone's back in. The public at that point is still in. I'm up there snapping pictures. And John Tory makes his appearance. And when he goes up to the microphone to speak, that's when protests began. I'm sure people have seen videos, heard that, you know, they're chanting. What was the, why am I blanking on the chant? It was, how's the homeless feed the poor, kick John Tory out the door. How's the homeless feed the poor, kick John Tory out the door.
I absolutely love that they wouldn't let him speak. I know there's going to be a lot of folks that were like, oh, this is part of the process. He's, you know, you're interrupting. Of course, you're going to get hauled out. But we have to remember this is a man who already resigned, right? Like days ago. So all the issues folks have with his budget and him previously, it doesn't matter. Like, this is a man who resigned and was still going to stand up there and preside over these budget meetings. And I love that because I don't live in Toronto, but I did. So I still consider myself a Torontonian and follow the politics way too closely. And I was just like, who are the cowards participating in these budget meetings with him presiding over it? Like, shut it down. I think that was my tweet. Like, shut it down. Like, and everyone was feeling the same way. And give him no space. I'm so proud of those folks.
Yeah. And a lot of the city councilors had kind of voiced a level of concern about that because they were essentially, due to the strong mayor powers, one of them interrupted to clarify that would the city councilors be allowed to vote on the budget today? The answer was no. Because of the strong mayor powers, they could amend small portions of the budget.
How much?
I think less than 1% from what I heard. And for the majority, the budget was controlled by the mayor. The mayor was John Tory. He would resign at the end of the day. Just a little spoiler alert, I guess. He was there to pass his budget. And several of the councilors were uncomfortable with that. So the protest, you know, and the speaker says, you know, I warned the public if there were any interruptions, you would be kicked out. That's it. Would everybody, including media, clear the city hall chambers?
I just want to say something about those superpowers in the budget while it's on my mind. I feel like those superpowers were specifically there to preserve those police budgets. Amongst a few other things, like the capital budget is even bigger and there's lots of issues there. But with all of the work being done to defund the police, right, to raise that issue and press it at council and elect folks that are going to do it, that is one thing capital cannot afford, right? Which is one reason we want to defund it. Let's be honest. They protect capital, and Doug Ford is a huge police aficionado, and all conservatives are. And I think that plays a large part into it. You know, they want to manipulate the urban centers, but those police budgets are huge. Huge.
Massive. It's by far the largest part of the Toronto city budget.
For most municipalities, it is over, most of them are over half.
And taking this from a bit more of a, you know, like I like to phrase my arguments towards fiscal conservatives, I guess, a lot, because using their language to show the absurdity of it all. The police budget is taking away resources from the unhoused community. It's taking away resources from addressing mental health concerns, from addressing housing, from addressing the social economical conditions that are that lead to crime, that lead to the justifications they use for police. We've seen everywhere in the world that in investing in tackling social economic issues, that is how you tackle crime. Police do not solve crime. They show up after it's happened.
The same can be said about homelessness as well. Like we heard the advocate at the beginning of the episode, it costs money. It costs us actually more money. So if that's all that you give a fuck about, that is not actually being fiscally responsible. And not to mention horribly cruel, but like our moral arguments seem to fall flat a lot of the time. So I hear you having to give that conservative argument, but
yeah. And shout out to Finland, because
random shout out to Finland. Love
because
it.
No, because Finland ended homelessness, because they said it costs less money to house everyone than it does to deal with the effects of homelessness.
Yeah, and healthcare.
So, yeah. And so they said, let's end homelessness, and then they housed everyone.
All of these are policy choices, and I think I wanted to interject here before folks get removed in your story to allow folks to understand where they're coming from, right? And the desperation, I think you heard at the beginning there, where there's no time to lose. There's no reason it has to be this way. And this is all on top of an incredibly undemocratic process of a mayor that should be gone and superpowers that shouldn't be there. So, you know, that's where these activists and advocates and community members trying to survive are coming from in this meeting, where they've had no input into their city budget so far.
Absolutely. And it's also worth pointing out the fact that the speaker is an ally of John Tory, who, like I said, in the scrum was saying that John Tory should remain as mayor. And that speaker, made the decision to kick out the protesters immediately.
She was a big fan of Ford, too. She did facilitate his reign as well.
And she has a lot to gain from Tory remaining as mayor. She has personal interests at work here. So in terms of, you know, democracy and biases and everything, that needs to be said. And so she announces clear city council chambers, including media. No member of the media left immediately. That needs to be said. There's nobody who said, okay.
No bootlickers to out.
Nobody immediately said, goodbye, we're gone. Media does not like being told what to do. That is a I heard someone say, that is a quote directly from some camera operator of some major publication. Media does not like being told what to do. And they stayed for a second. They stayed to cover things. And a lot of them stayed a lot longer than a second, because and at this point I have to say, I don't have a perception of time. I have no idea how long it took for police to come in, but I do know it was a very significantly long feeling period of time. And during that time, media went around interviewing the protesters. And they were talking with them. That's where that speech comes from.
I just want to make sure Desmond Cole was the only person that we could find that posted the longer comment the longer speech at the beginning of the episode. That is the credit that we'd like to provide that audio to. And you can see all their mics there, yeah? But we did search online, and very few of that person's words made it through to the mass media, even though they were there to record it.
Yeah. So that I think that says so much about like what we're going to talk about in a little bit about the role of media here. And so at this point, I'm as a student journalist, I'm feeling quite nervous about my place here. And I start talking to a journalist who I didn't know. And I tell them, I'm a student journalist. Media has been asked to leave. I noticed that a lot of you are staying. I would like to stay. Will I? And they tell me, hey, they know my editor. They know the professor who I'm responding to, and they say, you're going to be fine. Stay with me. We're going to stay until the end. Right? And at that point, it's like, yeah, I'm staying, you know? They want media gone because they don't want people to see what is about to happen. And we stay. And I'm far away at one point taking pictures. And at one point, the journalist, he turns to me and he says, no, it's not DSLR time. Right now, pull out your cell phone, press record, and go.
You're going to miss a frame.
Yeah. And at first, I have it held vertically because, you know, I'm not thinking anything. And he's like, no, horizontal, always horizontal.
Capture as much as possible.
At this point, I'm just being guided by this journalist. This journalist knows my editor. This journalist tells me I'm going to be okay. This journalist is giving me instructions. I am following because I am scared in this situation. I'd almost feel more comfortable sitting there with the protesters waiting to get arrested. But as a journalist, I was lost. And I did not know what to do. So I was following the lead. And security comes up to me several times and they say, we've asked you to leave. Please leave.
Go up to everyone and do this? Or they
go up to everyone. They honed in on me. I'm a student journalist.
Without any press creds?
Yeah. Well, at that point, I was accredited in the sense that I had other students with me. It was very clear who I was, what I was doing. And they said, we've asked you to leave. Media has been cleared. Please leave. And I tell them, I will stay until my people leave. And by my people, I'm referring to the journalists. I'm referring to my classmates.
That's not what I thought you meant.
No. But I point to the journalists. It was clear in that moment. But I'm.
But in your heart, though, I feel like you meant the other people.
I did.
I know you're supposed to remain professional, and I might be getting you in more trouble. But when you say my people, and you needed to stay, it wasn't for them, the journalists. They were giving you cover, you know. You were staying for your people, your community members.
Absolutely.
I know you were.
Absolutely.
And I'm so proud of you for staying.
And I was at that point, I accepted all the possible consequences, you know, there. And I got a chance to talk to Desmond Cole there for a second, someone who for me is a big inspiration, is the type of journalist that I have the pleasure of attempting to emulate, you know.
You have a label for Desmond, right, as a journalist?
Yeah, he's
not
an activist.
Just specifically Desmond, but
activist journalist. That's who I want to be. Me and Desmond, we almost got pepper sprayed together a couple years ago, Division 14, marching through the streets of Toronto. He had a megaphone chanting. I remember Desmond has for a long time been somebody who I admire. And I told him that. And it was a great experience for me. Just, you know, this is who I'm trying to be. This is what I want to do. I'm sticking here. I got my camera out. I'm just there recording, right? And from there, we get the footage that's up on Blueprints. The only other people who have that footage who have seen it are the Toronto Sun, because it was a Toronto Sun journalist who was taking care of me.
You probably didn't want to say that at first. I love how you made sure. Well, I didn't know who he was when I started talking to him, to my fellow lefties out there. But in the end,
I have to say, I have to say it. I have to give credit where credit is due. The Toronto Sun took care of me.
However, a point we wanted to make later on, and I guess like now is a good time, there are different rules for different people. Different people can go back to their editor and perhaps get a different response when working outside the confines set for them. You know, I appreciate that he looked out for you, but he may operate under a different set of rules.
Yeah, yeah. No, but he was pretty chill. You know, he was just he's not like a high up. I think he might be a sports journalist, to be honest. But he knew Miguel, and he was joking with Miguel, and he was telling me about hanging out in a bar with Miguel. So he had his own personal relationship with some of the community members who were there protesting, you know, something that I do too, you know. I know people there, he knows people there, and he's recording, he gets that footage, and, you know, we stay till the last second, they kick us out. And then he invites me down to the press gallery, to the Toronto Sun room. You know, they're joking, and at that point, I'm freaking out. I'm like, man, am I going to get in trouble? I tell them, I'm like, is my professor going to be angry at me? They said, no, they're not. And I can vouch for you. Tell them I was there with you. They'll remember me.
Because there was a little bit of fallout for some folks, some media people related to this incident, right? So Desmond Cole was denied access to Toronto Hall in response for 24 hours. And, you know, when that was tweeted out, there was a few other folks that chimed in that they also had received notice that they were persona non grata for 24 hours at City Hall in relation to being a part of the disturbance. So I just want to provide the audience, like, why would he be in trouble, right? If he was just doing what the other media were doing, or some of the other media, there was pushback on this. And
yeah,
we should be concerned about that, because the only reason, again, they were removing media was to prevent folks from seeing what they needed to see. And I think the footage that we got, like, correct me if I'm wrong, we wouldn't have gotten if everyone had left.
No. And at that point, a lot of media had left, but not all the media. And it was important to stay and record that, because that is the role of media. You know, like, democracy dies in the darkness. That isn't that like the cover of New York Times or whoever it is?
The Fifth Estate, for sure. But I think, like, I'm not in journalism school, but from our discussions, to me, I feel like there's two camps, right? There's two conflicting messages that you keep getting as a student journalist, and I don't, you know, media right across the plate might, that you are there to shed light on things that are happening, but you should be removed from it somehow.
Yeah.
Like, there should be no real purpose behind it. And that, like, opens a whole can of worms. It ignores inherent bias that's already in media. We were talking about this earlier, like the pro-capital bias that is in media. The heteronormative kind of way we use words is the same way we use words that are pro-capital, anti-worker, ableist, and all of this stuff. That is throughout what we consume in the media. But any kind of progressive lens, I feel like, is when we start hearing, you can't opine on this. That's an opinion piece. And what happened to you? So you covered this. Have you got to write about it?
No. Because, well, I mean, the last little bit is, you know, after that, I went back up and I asked the Toronto Sun guy, I'm like, am I going to be allowed back up there? He's like, yes. And if they give you any trouble, we'll talk to them. So we go back up. I'm up at the top, you know, there's no chairs though, so eventually I get uncomfortable and I go sit with another one of my classmates, and there was another protester, I guess, who managed to get back inside, who was sitting in front of me. At the end of the session, they started, they interrupted, they got kicked out once again. This time it wasn't clear the gallery wasn't the message. The message was, we're taking our regularly scheduled lunch break right now. And, you know, they acknowledged me as they were walking off.
He was there by himself?
Yes, he was there by himself. You know, he acknowledged me, making it seem like he knew me. And at that point, security came up to me. They're like, how did you get back in here? Implying that I should have already been barred. But then they recognized me there. And then they're like, we're going to ask you, you know, leave for the day. Okay. I left.
Wait a minute. You left out a part of the story that I really enjoyed. The protester who came back in was by himself. And when I spoke to Santiago, he said, I didn't want him to feel like he was by himself. I needed him to know I was with him. I needed him to know he wasn't alone. And so he leaned over and he whispered, you know, solidarity, comrade. Because, you know, the fist in the air was maybe a little too obvious at the moment. He was trying to do this as conspicuous as possible. And in response, the community member opted for a fist bump, which essentially outed you.
Yes.
We are not ashamed of it, but it did throw up a giant red flag over your head as possibly another activist journalist that needed removing.
Yes.
That's an important part of the story because I think it speaks to who you are, Santiago, and why you're doing what you're doing, friend.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess I didn't immediately say that because I'm a little bit worried about the consequences of that, because that was, at that moment, I'd been there for many, many hours. I was emotionally worn down and I got sick and tired of the happy birthdays and the clapping and the city council was just completely failing to acknowledge anything that had gone on. It was a very, for me, dystopian reality of like business as usual, nothing. That didn't matter. That did not matter. Like to them, it was like, just move on. And he was the only person who heard me whisper that. He was the only one. And I agree that if I am representing Humber News as an impartial journalist, that was likely a line that I crossed. But that line would prevent me from reporting on the story.
That would prevent you from being human. These restrictions that you describe, and as an activist and knowing you, and I am not versed in journalism etiquette. I don't give a fuck about etiquette, right? Like, decorum can go and whatever. Those confines set for you limit what you can do as a journalist and your humanity. Especially us, especially neurodivergent people. We wear our emotions out there like you don't know. Like the stereotypes people have, I don't understand, to be honest. And that need to, that feeling of empathy and solidarity that radiates from within, that drives all of this work, does not turn off, not for a second,
no.
Not. And it shouldn't, no matter the consequences. And those are the types of folks that we need more of, that do not worry about consequences, personal consequences, when it's coming to the greater good. And whether, and that applies to so many things. But to withhold your emotions and your experience from the day, to erase that from the story altogether is just it's a travesty, honestly.
And yeah, and that was it. I never screamed, I never shouted, I wanted to. I didn't. You know, I did. But that was it. And then I got an email from my editor essentially saying, you're either there as a protester or you're there as a journalist. You can't be both. And that he was like, at this point, I think it would be best if you were removed from this story. And I emailed him like, what about my footage? What about my pictures? I was like, I understand. Can the other students who were there with me use them? He was like, no.
You did not tell me that. That is why it was so important for you. Santiago sent me this video. He's like working from a cell phone, running around City Hall, dodging security guards, whatever, you know? And I was like at an appointment running around, but I could feel the urgency. I actually didn't speak to him. It was just through text message. And was like, you have to get this footage out. And like the intensity just kicked up a notch. I went to every platform I had access to, except I forgot Instagram. I'm sorry. And I just got it out there as fast as possible. And my fingers were working too fast because I just knew and I didn't understand. That speaks again so much to your values there that he did not want credit for this. We didn't even want credit. It was like, please just someone pick this up and use it. That was the sentiment Santiago had, like, get it out there. People need to see it. He was so excited, actually, when another media outlet took it and used it as part of their report. And I was so excited every time I saw a new view, right? Like, it was just, I knew it would mean something to him. But now it means more because you were there for hours. That was your experience, save from coming on this podcast now and sharing it. That was your outlet to process all of this. And they were asking you essentially to just keep it in the dark. And that must have felt awful. How did it feel to get removed from the story that you so desperately probably wanted to opine on?
I wasn't surprised. I know what the environment is, and I just, I stepped outside the door of City Hall, and it was, everyone had been gone by that point. There was no protest, and I just sat down on a bench by the ice rink, sat there for like maybe 40 minutes just thinking, and about everything that happened, what my place was in this industry and as a person. Because I knew where my heart was, you know, it was right there.
I think everyone did. That was probably the problem. Yeah, and we love you for it, but yeah.
And that's a part of who I am that I've always worn very honestly out there. You know, every second that I've been at Humber, I've communicated who I am, what I am here for. I am not here to work for the Toronto Star, for CBC, for Globe and Mail, CTV, whoever. I am not here to be an impartial, like, mainstream journalist. That is not who I am. I am with them. I'm with the people there. That's who I am.
Although you understood being removed from the party,
Freudian slip.
No, that was me. Sorry. So you understood being removed from the story from a kind of what you expected, right? You understand the environment, but you definitely don't agree with that sentiment that you have to be either a protester or a journalist. And when you use that kind of label for Desmond Cole as an activist journalist, I feel like there, in a way, there shouldn't even be the need for that label. Like, inherently, No. That's what it's there for.
No, and that's where I take a lot of issues, and I voiced that through my entire time at Humber, right? Because, like, I had a professor last year, Jim Coyle, who was, he was a journalist at the Toronto Star, very high up there, for his entire life. He's retired now. I mean, he still occasionally writes pieces for them. I know he has a lot of, like, the Queen's obituary he had written like years ago, and when they just had it ready to go, so his name was on that when that happened. It's not, anyways.
Oh, to be that famous that people have a whole your obit in stock.
They got it ready to go,
like a stock photo. My God,
yeah, okay. And Jim, you know, he has been a big part of me exploring who I am as a journalist. I speak to him about, like, the activism journalism. And he's like, yeah, you know, a lot of these opinions, the industry is changing. There is more room for that. People are acknowledging that that is a legitimate form of journalism, right? And that was like, okay, there's my fire. You know, like, that's who I am. That's what I'm doing. There are people at Humber.
You got permission.
Yeah, there's been people at Humber, professors, my mentors of mine, who have essentially said, yes, you are, what you're doing is a real thing. And so I even, and like on the topic of Desmond Cole, one time the one of the people who hires people for the internships at the Toronto Star, they came to speak to us in a class, and they were saying about how, you know, if you're a journalist, you can't be going to protests. And then they asked for questions, and I asked them, I'm like, Desmond Cole, you say the Toronto Star's official stance is that it was a mistake. The way they treated Desmond Cole was a mistake, that they shouldn't have done that, that Desmond Cole was in the right and they were in the wrong. That is their official stance to this day. And I said, me and Desmond Cole, because they had specifically mentioned encampment protests, and I'm like, me and Desmond Cole almost got pepper sprayed together, like just like last year. And but now you're, and you say that it was a mistake to get rid of him, but now you're telling me that I'm not allowed to do that either. You know, it's, that's the thing, right? Like, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable?
You get for some.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're feeling like you're facing some heat for this, right? A little bit still to unfold. But if we're talking about a fist bump and maybe a whisper, all right? Meanwhile, Brian Lilly is all up in this, hollering at protesters, right? Definitely giving his two cents in the moment. Do you think he faces heat when he goes back to the office?
No. Columnists are...
Did he even get a 24-hour ban?
No. Columnists have long been given that permission, right? And columnists seem to be valid. But also, like, even like... And I'll get into that in a second, but even like beyond like the Brian Lillies of the world, like Jim Coyle, my professor, who was very established in the Star, told me that, you know, they take the same planes as the politicians, that he has had many conversations. He wrote a book about his struggle with alcoholism, and he told me that Brian Mulroney, I think it was, gave him like really good advice for tackling his alcoholism. And then Jim Coyle goes and, you know, like he has to write stories about these people too. They have personal relationships with these politicians. They know them. I know these protesters. They know the politicians.
That's different to them. One is saddling up to power and the other one is being disruptive to that same system. So like, I know a lot of the shit that goes on with media that we complain with comes from deadlines. And, you know, we talked about space and air, right? Like the reports from these folks that were there feature just a tiny snippet of what we aired the entirety of and what Desmond Cole captured and posted in its entirety. And it's really selective, but to a purpose. There's always time, space, and resources for the other voices, right? For the plane trips alongside politicians, for the dinners. These relationships aren't questioned. But, you know, folks like you or you know, Desmond Cole and other independent media out there are criticized for it.
You know what's funny? You know where they draw the line when it comes to stuff like dinners? They draw the line at money. They draw the line at, like, they can't buy you dinner, you can't buy them dinner, you know? As long as there's no exchange of capital goods.
But your fist bump, right? Like,
that's the thing with the protesters.
It's a different story.
We don't have any money going between us. We're not, you know, like, there's none of that. None of that at all. There's no capital goods at all. They see these idea on the left, they see leftists with ideological biases as the same as financial biases, but that only applies to leftists.
To be fair, like, I think protesters also in general face a certain sort of scrutiny. That's why, like, I've tried my best to avoid calling folks that throughout this, because, you know, one of the comments that I got on Twitter was not everybody went there to actually protest. And like, you didn't go there to essentially take sides either, but stuff unfolds. People get angry, humans react, and it's within your right to do that. And yeah, so folks that were there to voice their opinion were hauled out of there, and the media trying to do their job were hauled out of there. And all of this is just incredibly undemocratic, and it feels like this message that your journalism students are receiving is to prop that up. You know, to step aside when power asks you to step aside and to turn and look away when things are unfolding. That's it's such a collapse of democracy, to be honest. And it's so hypocritical, again, for advocates of free speech and whatnot to then turn around and say folks absolutely deserve to get hauled out of there and silenced and whatnot.
Yeah. And then what happened to me after?
Yeah.
Well, I got a... After that email that I already went over, I got an email from my program coordinator informing me that they, along with another professor who was an accomplished CBC journalist, want to talk to me on Tuesday, Monday's family day, so Tuesday, about my, quote, actions while representing Humber News, unquote.
See, I wish you had a rabble rousers press creds there, because I think you represented very well with integrity and determination and principles. And it upsets me that this friction, and let's say it's just a meeting. Let's say it's just voices of discouragement to not do that again. That still pisses me off because you're they've singled you out clearly. But you're not the only journalism student receiving these messages and then going out into the world and feeling like they are conflicted. Like, what do I do? Am I going to get in trouble if I say this or do this from my editor, even though I know it's the right thing? When we talked about that, we were drawing parallels. So, you know, candidates within party systems feel this way. Elected folks feel that, like, this pull of saying what I really mean, doing what I know needs to be done, and working within that safety space. That what my bosses will accept of me, what the public will accept of me, what the media won't have a heyday with. And it's also very restrictive. And it always seems like on our part, right? Like on the part of speaking truth to power.
Yeah. And you know that there's no legal definition of a journalist in Canada. Like journalists don't have any legal special protections, technically.
Anyone. I did not know that.
No, there's no like, you don't get like a certificate that says, hey, you're now allowed to be a journalist. Anyone can be a journalist, technically speaking, right? So when it comes to these things, you know, like I like to think like I was doing the advocacy journalist, the activist journalist thing before I began as a student at Humber. I came into Humber with the goals not to become what they wanted me to become. I went in because I wanted to be a stronger writer.
Have or needed to hone.
I wanted to learn, like, about interviewing, about quotes, about writing, about structure, nut graphs and leads and cut lines and, you know, all
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, all the journalist mumbo jumbo. I wanted to learn how to do it because I said, you know, like, the people like me often don't get access to those skills through the institutions that provide those skills. And then you go into an environment that says, hey, no, actually, there's a specific type of journalist that we want you to be. Become that. And I've had my foot planted on the ground since the beginning and said, I am who I am. I'm becoming who I'm becoming. I'm going to work where I'm going to work. And that is, by all definitions, as valid journalism as anything else. And there can be, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like you already have a lot of people who are doing the type of journalism that they want. And I get that. And, you know, for people who believe in impartial journalism, you know, there's room for that. There's room for the whole whatever, like the notion of objectivity. I don't personally believe anybody can be objective. And the personal biases get in because even just in choosing what stories get told and what stories don't, that is a bias. There's bias in every single aspect of journalism. I see the type of story. I know because you talk to people, you see who they are as people, and then you see what kind of stories they talk about, and it becomes very clear, right? So there are biases, but I have always believed that as long as I'm honest about who I am, about what I'm believing, I'm not pretending to be impartial. I'm saying, these are my biases, this is how I believe, and this is how it's affecting my work. And then I go and I do the work. I think that's as fair as anything else. And so now, you know, like I've just been in the just the aftermath of this all. I've been stressed out, not sleeping enough, and that pisses me off because I'll be okay, I'll handle it. But what about, I'm 24, I've been in school for quite a while now. I was in music for 5 years before I went into journalism, and I had been an activist already. I you know, a lot of organizing experience, many campaigns. So I'm coming to this already with, you know, quite a solid idea. But what about the 17-year-old who is still figuring out what they want to do, and they're being told you have one option and you have to become this type of journalist and this is what we want? And then that's the type of, and then, like, you see the type of people who even then end up getting the jobs, who they hire, who they don't hire, you know? And that's how media, that's how you end up with the media that we have.
It's like so many of the systems out there, right? Like, you play by the rules, you are rewarded with proxy to power, but you are entirely ineffective. You become entirely ineffective when you just completely work within those kinds of confines. And you, like, started off by making it sound so easy. Like, I put my foot down and this is, I've been clear from the beginning and fought back. But 100%, there's younger people out there, people that are still finding themselves, people that don't need this kind of pushback because it's going to push them right down, right? You mentioned somebody that had been deterred from journalism altogether from this kind of messaging. The kind of people that we need telling stories.
For a long time, for example, security at Humber wouldn't let people record on Humber without a 2 weeks' notice. A ridiculous law, but to exist to protect the capital interests of Humber College, which of it there are many. And so they got kicked out by security. Eventually, the Canadian Association of Journalists, you know, they came firing. A lot of the mainstream publications were talking about this event. But that was enough to push this person out of journalism completely. They were done with it. And I've known other people who... There's so many people who drop out. And it's not the people who conform, absolutely, you know. You have to exist in this space and sacrifice who you are for 3 years to get that piece of paper. And if you don't conform, it's stressful.
It is. Like, and there's certain pressure for you to get that piece of paper, even though clearly the skill set you need was a lot of it will be obtained on the ground, right? Like, you told me so many lessons you just learned from your Toronto Sun buddy at City Hall, and I think back when I was in university and I took political science, and sure, I learned a lot of textbook stuff and had great, but the most I learned was through student organizing against the institution itself, whether that be for the workers striking or to divest from weapons or whatever, like going up against the rules. I learned far more. So I want to ask you to close this out here. At the beginning, I said it profoundly impacted you. I feel like your resolve has been strengthened. Now, this isn't to erase the anxiety that you have and the resistance that you're facing. Do you feel that way, or are you more wary now of your actions? Like, how will you act next time you go to City Hall?
Next time I go to City Hall, it won't be for Humber News. And I don't even know if they'll let me into the door, but I know that I'll reach out to Desmond Cole and say, hey, how do I do this? You know?
Desmond, if you're listening.
There's nothing that they can do to take away my fire, but they can hurt me. And they have hurt me. Because throughout the story I mentioned, I spent the entire time talking to established journalists. I did my due diligence. I did my due diligence. At all points in time, I made sure it was okay for me to be where I was. And yes, I have a personal connection to several of the people who were there. I could not have foreseen that coming. I don't think that that is enough for me to get into any sorts of trouble at Humber. But that's where I'm at. And it pisses me off because what about the next person? What about the next person? I can take it. What about the next person? It's not fair. And I just want to get out. That's where I'm at right now. I want to get out. I don't want to be there. I don't want to be in that space. I learned the skills. At this point, they've dropped teaching me. They don't teach me anything anymore. They just give me assignments. It's the practice. It's unpaid labor. No, it's worse than that. I'm paying them to do labor for them, to run their media networks. I'm paying for that. I understand that, like, you know, if a journalist working for the Toronto Sun or a Star, working for the Toronto Star, gets told they can't do something it fucking sucks. But under capitalism, you know, the financial interests are, you know, there's consequences. You do this, you don't get paid, and that limits people. Here, I'm the one paying them, and then they're. So they're not even teaching me. I feel like if I was to walk out of the door tomorrow and start doing the thing, I would learn more underground than I would ever learn in their classrooms anymore. This whole semester, they have not. There's no lectures. There's no talking about different scenarios and different things. No. I walk in. They say, here's your assignment. It's due within a week. Go. And that's for every single class. And the students are burnt out. There was a meeting yesterday. I couldn't go because I was so burnt out over this. But there was a meeting talking about the workload where students are like, we can't do this. We can't handle this. They're not teaching us. They just give us stuff to do. They don't inspire us. Jim Coyle, shout out to Jim Coyle. I miss that man every goddamn day of my life. Jim Coyle would inspire us. He would talk about his experience and talk about journalism and light the fire up. Of like, why do you want to do this? But now they're just treating us like, oh, like, you got to do this. So we don't have to inspire you. We don't have to motivate you. We're just going to work you. You are workers now. So I don't want to be there. But at the same time, I have very real consequences from leaving.
Well, like you say, like, you need that piece of paper outside of the knowledge. And I'm feeling a little triggered. There's a little bit that makes me think, you know, they want folks like you to leave. You know, you inspire your classmates. And when you put your foot down, you give other people strength to do the same. That's the same inside your classes. It's been in all the lessons that we've learned out here, right? That act of resistance is a spark for other people. And they know that. And a little part of them wins when we walk away. But I want to tell you that whether activism journalism is a fucking thing or not, whether or not you knew every single person and knew exactly what they would likely do at City Hall, because that's what should be done, that's what you advocate for all this time on Blueprints of Disruption, you would expect nothing less of them shutting John Tory down. And none of that should matter. None of that should matter. If you had been given the freedom to work on a piece, a meaningful piece from that, it would have been epic. If you had been allowed to put your emotions into there, if you were allowed to put your opinion into there, as well as the context given by the facts on the ground, you know, it's not in an absence of facts that you write. It accompanies this. And all of that should not matter to them. It may, if, you know, we're talking about a set of rules and guidelines, but it should not. And you know that. And that's why it hurts so bad. You shouldn't have to sit here and justify that, you know.
No. And I want to take a mention to throw it back to a previous episode. The conversation we had with Kevin from The Hoser, where, and this is the example of, I'm going to give of why biases are necessary, right? Division 14, Lamport Stadium, encampment, eviction. No media network gave that proper coverage. None of them talked to the people on the ground. None of them got the real story. They just said violence breaks out against police, yada, 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 you know. Kevin stayed there. He talked to people. He was there all day. He got the stories. And you know what? It wasn't an opinion piece. It was real, good journalism. It's out there. And that's the benefit of these biases, you know, is you stay, you talk to people, they trust you.
But there's also a fight to be had. There is a fight to be had, and you're playing in it. You can't remove yourself from it. You would die. And I say that as it comes out of my mouth, it sounds so harsh, but I know, because when I remove myself from the fight for any reason,
absolutely,
it's painful. And so if you were to take one passion and remove it from the other, it would destroy you as a human being. You would not be Santiago Helu Quintero anymore. you would be something else, something that they've created and shaped for capital's purpose. And you would have to start doing what you need to do just on your free time. I mean, that's part of what we're doing here, right, at Rabble Rousers, like trying to make space for this kind of storytelling without consequence.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fundamental. It's fundamental. Like, it's my purpose. It's why I'm here. It's why I decided to study journalism in the first place, you know? It's what we need. Like, it's what we need. We need more people. You know, the right has the National Post, the Toronto Sun, and Dare. They get away with everything because technically they're a tabloid, but they still, the Toronto Sun, it is a tabloid. It is recognized as a tabloid, but they get in the door. They are allowed in the door. They are treated with validity. They're valid in this world. But where we don't get to have that, we don't get to have, and I mean, it wouldn't be like, as I say that, it sounds like, no, like we're not going to be that level of hacks, but
we want to be trash and be allowed in places too.
you know what I mean? It's to say that, like, when it's from the left, it's not okay. In this world, when it's from the left, it's not okay because we present a fundamental challenge to the existing structures. And that's the thing. Not challenging structures is also an ideology. And it's also a privilege. And I know we've gone long, but I need to... This is a point I really need to make because we have had multiple classes reporting for diverse communities, you know? It's so funny because they talk about all of these like very real material conditions that affect people from different communities. And then they say, you know, you look around the newsrooms are still dominated by white men in Canada. Every newsroom is dominated by white men in Canada. Why is that? Well, a lot of it is because when a person comes from an experience, when a person comes from a community, that lived experience is perceived as a bias. That lived experience is treated as a bias. And so they're not allowed in the door. And it is a privilege to be unopinionated. It is a privilege to say, this world is working enough for me. I'm okay. I don't need to challenge things.
I'm not political. We hear that all the time.
But especially for a journalist, you know? It is a privilege. It is a privilege, and it's something that they don't see that. It's so, like, as they're teaching these classes, they don't see that. They don't understand that, and I challenge it all the time. And I'm sure that's part of this, but
that privilege has been so normalized, right? Especially in media. That is the voice. That is the standard voice that appears to have no bias because it is so normal, right? It's like an accent. You don't think you have an accent because everyone around you is speaking the same way, right? Whatever, in a melting pot. But you do. You have a bias, but when it is so mainstream and it is propping up the status quo, it's almost invisible. But folks coming from communities that need to resist in order to survive, that is obvious too, right? That is much more seen. That is in their language. That is in their actions. That is in their being, right? And so it's so much more visible. It's often visible in the sense that it's racialized folks. But even when it's not, I mean, it's that bias that's easy to catch because we don't hear enough of it. It's that accent that floats in.
You can't be impartial when something is an existential threat to you, you know?
I don't think you can be impartial, period.
Yeah, me neither.
I think it ends right there. That's it. That's the period. Tweet.
but that's also like what journalism needs to understand. And then it's like, okay, so then what about everyone else? What about everyone who's not a privileged white man who doesn't need to have opinions about things? What about the rest of us? And that's why advocacy journalists, activist journalism, whatever they want to call it, is as valid as anything else. The status quo is an opinion.
It absolutely is. it's not just valid, it's far more needed than what we're actually consuming most of the time. It adds far more value to discourse, to social consciousness, to being that fifth estate that is supposed to provide the populace with the information that we wouldn't normally get from those in power, right? That is its purpose. And like a lot of things has strayed from its purpose thanks to capitalism and the restrictions that are there, right? And it's like such a detriment. And the resistance people face like has real emotional and psychological consequences. It's like there hasn't been one person on our show that, and this isn't to minimize your experience, that doesn't feel resistance way too often. You know, like we start to steel ourselves against it from the outside. We've talked a lot about this on the show, but it's pertinent here. But when that fight seems to come from the inside, like your school, you know, I know you're paying to be there, but it's still your community. It's your school. There's something still very organic and community-like about it. And when you start to have to fight there, on top of all the other fights that are valid, that need to be fought, it is too draining. It is really hard. It is really discouraging. So, like, I know that it's like lit your fire and again, but I also see that it's worn on you, you know, and all the other people we've had on our show that just have to consistently persevere and pretend to be resilient when we're not. And it's just so much resistance from so many fronts, unnecessarily so, sometimes where you don't expect them. Like, I know you know that was the environment that you would likely take maybe some heat or at least couldn't be on that story, but it still doesn't feel good. And anything that leaves anybody with that kind of feeling just shouldn't be. Something's wrong.
No, and like to make matter worse, I was already burnt out before this happened. It was already a difficult moment for me. This has just added to it. And you know, just to like present like the universal nature of it is that this is the same feeling that I've seen draw so many people out of the fight. Those fights from within, those civil wars, those internal struggles. I've seen it burn out so many people who sometimes never come back. And that's why it's difficult and it's... I don't know. It's
like I had no idea how this episode would shape up, but when you called me, I just knew that people needed to hear it because it impacted me just hearing your experience. You know, obviously the neurodivergent in me is always like relating it back to things in my life, but it also just spoke to so many bigger issues as well. And I know it's not easy for you to unload like this. We have our cameras off today, so no YouTube video, because this is draining. This is deeply personal. We've done a few episodes like this, but it is a bit off the regular path that we take. But it's a story that we needed to get out there. And if this isn't an outlet for us to work through our own fights, then I don't want it, right? Because people are going to relate. We do not live in a vacuum. If you're going through something like this, there's other people going through something like this. Lord knows, I feel like I, you know, can relate to this experience on some level. So I find it, you know, healing in a way to kind of work through it with you. And I hope our audience does too.
I want to take a moment here at the end to just give a shout out to everybody who showed up, that they made their voices heard at personal risk, personal sacrifice, odds stacked against you, but they showed up. And that is what democracy is supposed to be about. That's what democracy looks like, you know? And I want to be there for you guys every single time. I want to be there. That's what I want to do. That's who I am.